You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Friday, May 6th, 2016, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, hello.
So we're recording a bit early this week because we're at Nexus. This is the week. This is the show comes out on the Saturday that we're at Nexus, so we have to record it early so we can get it in the can when we're at the conference.
Time travel.
Time travel, yep, always. Podcast time travel. Kind of like the hot tub time travel.
Kind of.
Exactly like that.
Yes.
Did you guys hear the follow-up on the Bodie McBoatface story?
No.
Yeah, I'm disappointed.
I'm sad,
I didn't hear about it. What happened?
Kind of not too sad.
So Bodie McBoatface, for quick review, is the UK's new polar research vessel that they opened up to the public to vote on what the name should be. And of course, Bodie McBoatface won the public vote. But they decided not to go with the public vote, much like the Republican Party would like to do. And instead, instead, they named it the Sir David Attenborough, which, okay, I mean, you know, how could you be upset at the RSS Sir David Attenborough?
Because of his statement about the abominable snowman might be real.
Well, whatever.
Okay.
Oh, God. Really?
I
suppose. No.
Yes.
Wait. It's not even Bigfoot. It's the abominable snowman.
Is that
the
Yeti?
That's what it says in quotes.
That's the Yeti, right? The Himalayas.
Yeah. And he's a little weak on the whole Bigfoot thing, but you know,
the abominable snowman is real at Disney World.
And in Bugs Bunny cartoon.
And it's a really fun roller coaster, by the way. If you haven't been there,
it is. It's cool.
Animal Kingdom.
It's cool.
Yeah.
A couple of our readers pointed out that it's not a boat, it's a ship. So it should be Shippy McShipface.
But for some reason,
oh,
the
great.
Word boat,
that'll be all ship face.
The word boat is funnier than ship.
Without
yeah, but McShip face?
Yeah, McShip face. Yeah, that doesn't work. But when I tell people how to spell my name, like when I go to the bank or I'm applying for something and they say, what's your name? Santa Maria. I always just, instead of spelling it, because it takes too long, I always say it's two words, like the boat. I don't know why. I want to say boat. Boat's a better word than ship.
Ship is more regal, though.
Ship is more regal. Boat is funnier.
Yeah, and it can't be confused with a swear.
Exactly. That's true. Two words like the boat, it makes more sense than two words like a shit. You have to believe that.
Exactly.
That doesn't make any sense.
But there was a consolation, though. They're going to name some other vessel Bodie McBoatface, right?
Yeah, like one of its submarines, I think. Something on the boat, which is kind of cool. Except something nobody will ever refer to.
The lifeboat.
Right. The lifeboat. Saved by Bodie McBoatface.
Yes. The Attenborough's going down. Everyone to Bodie McBoatface.
Well, it's a cool looking like exploratory sub, right?
Yeah, it's like a sub thing.
Torpedo
it does
almost.
Look like a bomb a little bit.
But what about the whole idea that they put it out there? Like, look, you can vote and we're going to pick the one that – and they just said, nope. And I predicted this, by the way. I did say that they weren't going to go with Bodie McBoatface.
It really is. I don't know. I've talked to some of my British friends about this. Some of my British friends are really torn about the idea of the legacy of kind of loving the royals and the fact that there's sort of a monarchy that doesn't do anything anymore in the UK. And some of them really hate the idea that there's a monarchy. But there is something very patriarchal about like, yes, vote for the name. And then once people vote, like, yeah, you are dumb children. We need to come up with something
more
appropriate.
And that's what you get when we put choices in front of people.
Well, but ways to do that don't crash and burn like this. Like, for example, you take open suggestions privately, not publicly, or if you open it up to a public vote, you have people vote on a list of pre-approved
options. You limit it. You don't leave it open.
But
they're lucky they didn't get all kinds of swearing.
Exactly. Bodie McBoatface is like a, I mean, it's ridiculous, which I love, but it's appropriate at least.
Right, there's nothing inappropriate.
No, but apparently they wanted something more. What did they say?
It's not raunchy.
I think they used that term. Yeah. They wanted something more appropriate or something more like befitting.
Yes,
a research vessel.
Something not as silly.
I think this is a total net positive, though, because sure, people are bummed, and who? No one could have predicted that it would go so viral. But sure, people are bummed, but they got so much name recognition now.
Sure.
So many people know about this that would have had no clue
about
this boat. And they made, I think it was a nice gesture to name that little exploratory sub Bodhi McBoatface. And yeah, they never were going to go with it, but I think this is a definite net positive for them.
So let me ask you a question. Did you guys see a picture of the ship?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
So did Coca-Cola pay for the ship?
It is Coca-Cola,
right? Right. With that stripe.
They have the stripe, like the racing stripe, but at one point it sort of swirls up and over, and you look at that section, it's basically the Coke symbol.
Well,
I wouldn't doubt it.
I think it's inadvertent.
It's no logo,
I think it's inadvertent,
yes, think
and
so.
It's clearly
it's my guess.
They were having massive PR problems. You know, whoever's in charge of this should be fired. All right, anyway,
you're fired.
You're fired. Let's move on, Bob. Tell us. Yeah, but we have a forgotten superhero of science this week.
Yes, for this week's Forgotten Superheroes of Science, I'm covering Yvonne Brill, 1924 to 2013. She was a pioneer rocket scientist. She contributed to many new rocket and jet systems, including her own patent for a breakthrough satellite propulsion system. Brill had some problems, as many women did at that time, with education and employment. At the University of Manitoba, her gender prevented her from studying engineering like she wanted to, and she had to take up mathematics and chemistry. Later in life, regarding one of her job, she said, "I always remember there was a very old line person, typical stodgy old line person in charge of personnel, and his argument was, how could a woman with 3 children ever get to work on time? Years later, he apologized to me and said I really had worked out very well." And that she did. During Brill's career, she had hands-on development for many critical propulsion systems, like the first weather satellite, which was called Tiros, the Mars Observer, and even the rocket motor for the space shuttle when she worked for NASA in the early 80s. My favorite work of hers, though, was the hydrazine resistojet. She even has a patent for this now industry standard device. What it does is it electrically heats a propellant, hydrazine, which expands to supersonic speeds, like just like a chemical rocket. And so communication satellites use this system for station keeping. It's also been used for orbital insertion or deorbiting. And it was an incredibly important invention for one reason. One big reason was that she used one simple fuel. So it wasn't a complicated mixture of multiple fuels. This made it cheaper, saved millions of dollars, and it allowed for more payload or extended missions. So it was really big. Really big win for her. I believe for her eulogy, Mike Griffin, president of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, said of Brill, "She truly represented the best of what American aerospace engineering and system development should be, a pioneering spirit coupled to a clear vision of what the future of an entire area of systems should be, with the ingenuity and genius necessary to make that vision a reality." So, remember Yvonne Brill? Mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing electrothermal hydrazine thrusters with a 400-second specific impulse.
You know, when I was just doing that last week, for sure.
It has to be 400.
Specific.
400.
Not 399.
No, that's what was that reference, somebody, you guys?
What, 300?
No, 400. Both Simpsons of them at the same time went 400. Like, what is it?
400's a take on 300.
Oh, I see.
Which is a Family Guy joke from way back when.
See, I didn't even know where it came from, but I started
you requested 300. Kara, tell us about this breakthrough on growing human embryos.
Yeah, it's called sex.
And see,
well, that is a breakthrough.
There were two articles published this week, one in Nature and one in Nature Cell Biology. And, you know, many, many researchers here mostly focused on Zernica Goetz, Magdalena Zernica Goetz, and I will never be able to pronounce this name, Ali Brivenlew. And these authors basically, we're trying to grow a human embryo outside of the womb, which it's interesting. But when you think about developmental biology, there are textbooks, there are courses, there are advanced level courses written about this topic. Developmental biology is something that we know an awful lot about. We can compare a lot of different species. We can see it happening in certain organisms. But when it comes to human developmental biology, there are still some real enigmas, because it's totally unethical to implant an embryo into a human being and then study its growth just for science. So there's kind of certain parts of the scientific process that break down a little bit. A lot of the research came from the 50s before we had certain ethical standards in place. And now researchers have been trying to grow embryos outside of the body, so in vitro as opposed to in vivo. And they haven't been very successful. Previous to this report, the longest that scientists have been able to grow the embryo and, you know, watch it differentiate, watch it go through the cycles that are necessary for embryonic development is about day 9. Apparently, about day 7, the embryo actually attaches to the uterus and a lot of changes start to manifest. And that's really that black box part of the process that we've had a hard time studying. In this paper that was both different versions of the paper that were both published in Nature and Nature Cell Biology, researchers managed to keep the embryo alive pushing 14 days. The reason 14 days is significant is because there's kind of an agreement that's both legal and ethical that was put into place across many nations and across many kind of science consortiums that you can't grow an embryo outside, a human embryo outside of the body for longer than 14 days. It's a bit of an arbitrary cutoff point. There's a lot of reasons behind it. Yeah, basically you're not allowed to do it. Before that wasn't really an issue. It was kind of a moot point because nobody had been able to pull it off. But these researchers were actually able to get right up to that 14-day limit. And they did, of course, sacrifice the embryo, terminate the research because they didn't want to go over that ethical limit. So that's really where I think a lot of questions are going to come into play. Now that there is evidence that we can go past that 14 days, is the wealth of information, the wealth of clinical information that we can gain from doing it enough to start to repeal those ethical boundaries or maybe to start rethinking them? What do you guys think?
It is definitely tricky because, you know, it's a human being. Mm-hmm. Even though it's still, you know, in the embryo phase.
Yeah, it's a little blastocyst at this point. So it's a bunch of differentiated, well, at first it's undifferentiated cells, and this is kind of right when they start to differentiate into things that look meaningful.
Yeah, so I mean, I totally understand that we got to be careful about doing human research, you know. I think if they could keep it alive and viable outside the womb, then fine. You know, then it's doing research on it is reasonable.
Exogenesis.
Yeah.
But what is the point where, you know, if the line in the sand was 14 days prior, and it seems like the reasoning for that was that once the cells really do start to differentiate, that's when it starts to become recognizably human.
Yeah, but it's totally arbitrary,
right? Totally so then arbitrary. The question is, what is the new arbitrary line? Yeah, but where do you draw
the new
line?
I'll tell you where. Right up until the point where you could legally have an abortion.
Interesting.
Why not? They should follow.
Yeah, but Bob,
those
why would you
laws?
Think that that line in the sand is valid as well? I mean, you know, this topic is so volatile because people are freaking out over the idea, and I am in the mix here. You know, like I'm emotionally engaged about this as well. You know, where is it a human life? And you know, it is something to debate. There isn't a clean place to draw that line, and that's part of the problem.
And we have to remember that there's no guarantee that we have the capability. Actually, it's almost impossible that we have the capability at this point to continue the experiment. We don't understand at all the full environment of hormones, of substances that are required in the embryo to help, or I'm sorry, that are required in the uterus to help this embryo grow and fully differentiate. So pushing the experiment is an unknown. We don't know how long it would take for this thing to die.
15 days, 45 days.
It's one thing to say we know for sure that we could push it to 3 months, but it might die after 10 days. So you start over, then it dies after 12 days, then you start over and you keep pushing, pushing, pushing. Where is that point of no return? That's really, I think, the big question.
Now, but is there any limit on doing this to chimpanzee embryos?
I'm not sure about chimpanzees. I'll tell you that generally speaking, from what I have been reading about this article, a lot of the protocols for this were developed in mice. And one of the really interesting things about this published research is that at this age, pushing 14 days, we are so far beyond any earlier research that we're starting to see things that don't exist in mice or things that are wildly different in human embryos than in mouse embryos. So we're starting to understand that the mouse model might not be amazing. Now, we are seeing some work using chimpanzee embryos here, but I do know that laws are being a little bit tightened. And in certain countries, the ethical regulations around great apes are significantly stronger than in the US. I remember doing a story probably 3-4 years ago now, so I'm not sure where the legal limit is anymore. But we were one of the last three countries in the world that still did research on chimpanzees.
Yeah.
It's very rare now in developed nations that individuals will do invasive non-behavioral research.
It's hard. It's a very hard thing to discuss because of the layering here. You know, one thing is you're talking about a human life, a potential human life. It's just scary, especially if you have children. You know, now that I'm a father, I've had children for just under 3.5 years. Wow, did my perspective change. When I was 20 and versus the late 40s version of me, I have a very different opinion. Secondly, it's not just the human life factor, but it is also the idea. Oh, I'm sorry, honey pot. Was I talking?
joined by an infant for this segment.
Courtney dumped off my baby girl because she's literally juggling three kids outside my door right now.
So she's literally juggling them? That's
wow.
I want to see that. Post it on Facebook.
When I say you juggling, too. It's like, you know, two of them are trying to be put to bed while she's got a 4-month-old in her hands.
That's way less cool.
The other side of the coin, and the thing that is troubling to me is, man, am I completely behind the need for the science. I totally understand why we want to do research here. The potential outcome could be profound, and the things that we discover might even help save lives in the future. Probably
yes.
will
so that's
help
the
save
point.
Lives
I mean, that's
the
hope, and that's the
you
point.
Can say that about a lot of things, though.
But when we're talking specifically about the development of an embryo, there in many ways is a point-to-point connection there between why do we have IVF failures? What do we do during diseases of pregnancy? What do we do during teratogenesis in gestation? These are things that potentially could be studied with this model that we can really only, like I mentioned with the mouse, model prior to this.
Yeah, interestingly, the farther away you get from human, the more ethical, but the less scientifically relevant it becomes.
Exactly.
So there's that inherent dilemma.
Correlation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, can we do rhesus monkeys? You know, is that okay?
Probably. But that's where, that's
and how really, close are they going to be to humans? Closer than mice.
And that's right? such an interesting, I've always found that, and not to go down a really long rabbit hole, but that was the basis of the piece that I was mentioning when I did all that research into great ape research, because I was talking about animal research in general, and where is the line you draw in the sand? It's very easy for some people to say, I'm completely against animal research. Most of those people are not scientists. But really, when you start to nitpick, everyone has a line in the sand. Most people are okay with research on fruit flies. Most people are okay with research on nematodes. These are animals.
Yeah.
You know, these are still organisms.
I agree. That's my position, is that you draw a line somewhere.
But leave jellyfish alone.
Yeah. And so where is the line that you draw? For me personally, I can say outright after studying this and thinking about it ethically for many, many years, I draw the line at great apes, cetaceans, and elephants. I am not very comfortable with invasive research in, you know, whales and dolphins, elephants, and great apes. Beyond that, it's fuzzy. It is really fuzzy. Those are the same kind of ethical lines that I put in with zoos. I expect a certain level of enrichment in pens with those kinds of organisms. Mm-hmm. And I have a harder time when I see them not being taken care of to an appropriate level. Yeah. But other people have different lines. It's interesting.
It's very interesting.
You ask 100 people, they'll have 100 different answers.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. Well, thanks, Kara. Let's move on to the next item. This is about overprescribing antibiotics. This is an old issue that I'm sure we've talked about at least in passing before, but there's been a new study that tries to estimate the degree to which physicians are overprescribing antibiotics. And what they did was they estimated the number of prescriptions that are actually being written, and then they estimated the just by disease incidence the number of antibiotics that should be indicated in that population over that period of time. And what they found was that about 30% of the antibiotic prescriptions might be inappropriate, might be, you know, unnecessary.
30%.
About 30% more than there should have been based upon estimates of the need and of the population, you know, based upon disease incidence. They said that sinusitis was the most common diagnosis treated with antibiotics in the outpatient setting. This is all outpatient, not inpatient, by the way. Followed by otitis media, that's basically a middle ear infection. Then pharyngitis and upper respiratory infections in general, such as colds and flus, were the most common type of infection treated with antibiotics. And in that, for those indications, for colds and flus, antibiotics were appropriate in only about half of the cases. About half the time, you know, doctors are giving prescriptions for viral infections, you know, that don't respond to antibiotics. Antibiotics, of course, only treat bacterial infections, not viral infections.
Why don't we have a rapid test?
Yeah, so that's to me, that's the interesting question now is, because this is old news. Yeah, we know that.
Yeah.
We know this is happening. This quantifies it in a more rigorous study than we've had before, but it's not out of the realm of what previous estimates were. But the deeper question of why is this happening is very, obviously, is very interesting. And that is the clue as to how we can fix it, because we know also the reasons why this is important, because we're rapidly heading into what many people think will be a post-antibiotic era or something like that.
Scary as
we're
hell.
Really close with gonorrhea.
And
there's more and more infections, more and more bacteria that are multi-antibiotic resistant. And they may be resistant to everything we have, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like we don't have antibiotics at all, hence a post-antibiotic era. And that's happening faster than pharmaceutical companies are researching new antibiotics. That's the key. You look at those lines. You know, how fast are bacteria evolving resistance, and how fast are we developing new mechanisms, new antibiotics that bacteria are not resistant to, and the bacteria are winning, is the bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what contributes to that evolution is the amount of antibiotic exposure. And so if we could reduce our antibiotic prescriptions by 30%, that would slow it down, and that would help. Carrie, you hit upon one thing, and that is that for many infections, you know, we have to do a culture, which takes at least a day, maybe two, to tell. For a lot of things, we don't have any of these like 15-minute tests where you could tell right away if there's a bacterial infection present or not. And even when we have like the rapid strep test or whatever, you still need to, in some cases, you know, confirm it with a longer culture. So it's the uncertainty that, you know, leads most physicians to give the prescription. So when you ask physicians about their prescribing practices, they say, well, they get a lot of pressure from parents or from patients, you know, but often in the pediatric setting, obviously parents of those patients. And if you combine that pressure with uncertainty, it's like, well, it could be a bacterial infection. I can't really be sure. I know statistically it probably isn't, but they could then just cover their ass by giving the antibiotic. The part of that problem is, so there's a disconnect between the risk versus benefit to that individual patient versus the risk versus benefit to society, right? And as physicians, we're trained to put the patient first.
Patient.
Over society. Yeah. You know, that's
because you're not epidemiologists. Like, that's not... Yeah.
It's part of our ethics, of professional ethics. We are the patient's advocate. We do what's right for them. This comes up in a couple of contexts. One is the cost of healthcare. You know, I'm not going to say to a patient, well, I'm not going to do what's statistically best for you because it's too expensive for society. You know, that's doesn't fly. Or it's by the same token, well, I'm going to accept a risk that you have a bacterial infection that I'm not treating because we don't want, you know, the problem of antibiotic resistance to be worsened. That's a genuine dilemma, you know. So what's interesting is like when I write about this or when you post it to Facebook or whatever, what do most people say is the problem, you know, like in the general public?
Oh, that they don't finish their antibiotics?
No. In terms of why we're over-prescribing antibiotics, it's, you know, big pharma, right? That's the narrative.
Oh, I see.
That's what everyone's saying. Oh, it's big pharma.
More pills, bit more money.
No, it's actually not. That's not correct. I mean, yes, it is true that pharmaceutical companies will promote their antibiotics to physicians, but that mainly has an effect on the brand loyalty. You know, that means they'll choose antibiotic A over antibiotic B. But that's not why they're overprescribing antibiotics in the first place. They're not saying, oh, I guess I'll give you an antibiotic because I have, you know, pens with the pharmaceutical company's name on it. What is the problem is the two things I've already mentioned, confidence and pressure, but also the solution to those problems is partly education. If physicians were more thoroughly systematically educated about the standard of care for antibiotic use, they would feel more confident in saying no. It actually takes more expertise to say no than yes. You know what I mean? Knowing that like a test may be helpful or a treatment may be helpful doesn't take as much experience and confidence and expertise as knowing that it's not helpful or that it's not necessary. Like, I feel confident enough that I don't need to do this test because clinically it's not indicated, as opposed to, I better do it just to make sure I'm covering all my bases. In fact, there's a correlation that, you know, higher expertise is associated with greater efficiency, basically doing less. When you have that sort of mid-level of competence but not really expertise, you tend to do a lot of stuff because you know all the stuff that you might need to do, but you don't have the thorough expertise to be confident in that you don't have to do certain things. So anyways, we have to raise the overall expertise of primary care doctors in terms of those evidence-based standards, but they also need support, right? So meaning that they need institutional support in that decision, which again is still tricky because you still are the patient's physician, but to say, listen, these are the published guidelines. And this is where part of this is the culture of medicine. I think we're at a tipping point. Up to this point, the culture of medicine is that physicians are rugged individuals, right? That they're experts who, through training, quality control is handled entirely through training, educating physicians to be more expert. And that's fine, but there are limits to how much information you could cram into people. Medicine is getting too complicated and the margins are getting too thin. You know, like we can't accept a 30% false positive rate, you know, because the implications for society, both expense-wise and antibiotic resistance and in other ways, is too great. So if you want to get, you know, beyond what you could get in terms of expertise just through training individuals, you need systems in place like checklists, you know, and published guidelines that are at the point of patient care that, you know, the doctor could point to and say, this is what's going to happen. This is actually a legitimate role for insurance companies, as much as I hate to say that, because physicians hate it when a bureaucrat second guesses them. But actually, I have to say, half the time it's just a pain in the ass, but half the time it's actually a perfectly reasonable level of quality control where you to some extent you want a bean counter going, nope, this doesn't meet strict guidelines, and then you have to justify why you're practicing in a way that doesn't adhere to strict guidelines. And maybe it forces you to learn what those guidelines are and to think about whether or not it is indicated.
I'm sorry. I have two things I want to bring up. In comparison to how physicians have to deal with the prescription, say, of narcotics, do you think regulations like that are imposed on physicians, if you were to do the same thing with antibiotics, would be a means of sort of helping this overall problem?
Not really. I mean, like making it a controlled substance.
Right. But for the obvious purpose of cutting down on the prescriptions.
It's not working for narcotics. Yeah. I mean, I would say that's not the kind of regulation that we need. Let me just say that. I don't think just having extra hoops that you got to jump through or just tighter sort of tracking is, I think, again, institutionally tracking how, like, physician patterns of practice, like, this guy's prescribing an awful lot of antibiotics, you know.
Right.
Maybe we should review this with him. And this is not to be punitive and not to punish or to shame doctors or anything, just to identify people who may need some further education. Maybe that they're laboring under some misconception about when it's appropriate to use antibiotics, and that could be easily fixed through education. So that's, again, the kind of institutional support that I think is necessary.
Right. Steve, I read the article. I don't remember seeing a section that talked about the incidence of prescribing antibiotics for a viral infection. Because to me, that's the most egregious.
Well, they did it by diagnosis, like for the cold, you know, for a upper airway infection, which sometimes you can get. Like if you have sinusitis, your sinuses are infected. And I've had this myself. You know, it's just not getting better. It's not getting better because you developed a bacterial super infection. And now you need antibiotics. Yeah. So sometimes it's appropriate. But you need to follow strict guidelines. And if you don't follow those guidelines, you're likely to overprescribe or prescribe it in cases where maybe you could have gotten away with just a little bit of lavage or just steroids or just something, you know, to clear out, or just drainage, you know, rather than antibiotics.
Steve, what could happen to you if you get a bad sinus infection? You don't get medicated. Like, can that kill you?
If it gets out of control, yeah. So,
well, any infection could kill you if it's out of control, right?
Yes, and bacterial infections. So, yeah, that's the thing. That's why. You know, it's like physicians, they mean well. It's like if you see one patient who you had delayed treatment of a bacterial infection, they develop meningitis or they develop a blood infection, for example, then it's like, yeah, that makes you really shy about avoiding the antibiotics. You know, you don't want that to happen again.
You could probably get sued for that, too.
Well, yeah. So people in general tend to be risk averse. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being risk averse in this case means just prescribing it just to be sure. And then that's a problem. So, but it is interesting to me the difference between the sort of the simplistic, it's big pharma narrative and the complexity of really handling a situation like this. There's a reason why this is happening. It's not,
right.
Again, the ease with which people assume that dedicated professionals are either simplistic or evil is like, yeah, are you really thinking about this? You know, this is a complicated problem.
I think you see the same level of kind of a lack of nuance with what I consider to be an even bigger problem in the United States when it comes to antibiotic overuse, which is antibiotic use in livestock. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's way more of the antibiotics that are produced in the United States are sold in to be used to bulk up food.
Yeah.
You know, they're not even really used for prevention or protection of disease. They're used to make animals larger.
Well, they're used to treat infections too.
They are, yes, yeah, that's true. I shouldn't say they're not at all, but yeah. The vast majority of them, we realized during times of famine that if you give antibiotics to animals, they get bigger faster, and that's a good thing. That
antibiotics, not the hormones or something like that.
No, antibiotics. Like 80% of the antibiotics in the U.S. are given to farm animals. And the interesting thing is that a big percentage of those, I think over 70% of those are medically important to humans. So this is where things get complicated because antibiotics were first developed for people. They were developed as a medical intervention for people. We utilize them because we learned later that they have a growth property in livestock. But these are antibiotics that are meant for people.
Is that considered an off-label use?
Yeah, right, yeah. And those types of things are important for us to remember, and they don't always come into the conversation. That said, it is nuance. We still need enough food.
Yeah, but the important question here, though, regarding that is how much is using antibiotics for livestock contributing to this potential of a post-antibiotic era?
Yeah, it turns out not much because it's different bacteria.
Okay.
Yeah, so
That's good.
Major bacterial resistance in humans is not coming from animal use of antibiotics.
You will see, though, when you start to really dive deep into this, I've read quite a few reports by science journalists, and I've started to see more conversations happening in the EU around trying to control these things than we see here in the United States, and studies coming out in the EU that do show that because there are medically important antibiotics being used in these animals, that there is a good chance that they're contributing. It's also something that's hard to know.
Plus, I have to point out that the 80% figure is disputed.
It is because some people calculate it differently.
Yeah, they
do it based on weight.
There's assumptions in how some people say it's apples to oranges, and it's not really a fair comparison.
The truth of the matter is, though, there are more animals in the United States than there are people.
Yeah.
And there are more antibiotics used in animals, exactly, than there are
people. We are eating them,
it is a physically larger number of drugs that are being used in animals. Whether or not that number really means a lot is how much does antibiotic use in animals, especially medically important, so important for people, antibiotics, how important is that to humans? And as we know, there are a lot of zoonotic infections out there. And a lot of epidemiologists are concerned about that. But again,
but also let me make one other point though too, is that because this is, you know, obviously this is a controversial issue, but it's also claimed that 87% of the antibiotics used in animals is actually for therapeutic purposes, for infections, not just for weight gain, not used in healthy animals. Yeah. Cool, because the animals get sick. They get sick, you know, and
yeah, exactly. Like, this is a debated topic because this is where the nuance, like you were just talking about, nuance comes in. It's just like the beautiful, I think, example that you are giving from the perspective of a prescribing physician. We often don't listen to the perspective of the people who are doing the husbandry, the people who are raising the animals. It's easy to sit on the sidelines and go, I don't want to have to get sick, and I don't want my, you know, bacteria to be resistant to these antibiotics. But antibiotics are necessary for a reason.
Yeah. Plus, also have to point out, and just to make sure we're covering this, is that according to regulations, when you give antibiotics to animals or to like cows who produce milk, you have to wait a certain amount of time until the antibiotics are out of their system before they can like give milk or meat to for human consumption. So the antibiotics in those animals are not getting into your food. That's a huge misconception. That's not what
you're not eating the antibiotics. I think they're usually used during the growth period.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Steve, I want to get back to your original premise and ask a question.
Sure.
What would be the activity that needs to take place in order to really solve this problem? Can we go beyond fixing, you know, most of that 30% misprescribed antibiotics? What else can we do? What should we be doing?
No, I think it's gonna. We could probably get it down to 20%, maybe 10%. It's never going to go to 0% because we're people. But let's say our goal is to get it below 10%, which I think is a reasonable goal of unnecessary antibiotic prescriptions in people. I think we could get there if we had systematic education and institutional review and feedback of antibiotic prescribing practices. Especially for those practitioners who prescribe a lot of antibiotics. Like, I never prescribe antibiotics. You don't got to worry about me. But like, if you're a pediatrician or a primary care doctor, you know, they prescribe a lot of antibiotics. So, you know, we know who to talk to. We know what the problem that we need fixing. It just has to be done.
Shouldn't we also be investing more in R&D of antibiotics? I mean, this is a problem, right?
Yes.
There's no incentive.
Billions of dollars.
There's not
the companies don't find the returns.
Yeah, there's not a big incentive because what makes money is diabetes medicine. Is medicine for chronic illness. So when you take an antibiotic once and you never have to take it again, there's not a good incentive. It may be something where we have to talk government subsidies. It may be something where we have to see some sort of political will or some sort of, you know, push from scientists and from consumers, not just from
A cooperation.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, they've got to do something at some point because this is one of those things, one of those developments that I find pretty damn scary because, the idea of going into a post-antibiotic era is holy crap.
Yeah.
I mean, that's scary as hell. I mean, you get a scratch and you'll be like, holy crap, is this going to kill me? And I'm just afraid we're not going to take this seriously until it's like too late.
We are very bad at being farsighted. But you know what? We are too myopic. We're bad at looking far into the future.
We're more reactive.
Well, Bob, how about this?
Proactive.
Try having surgery without antibiotics.
Oh, shit. Yeah, just watch The Nick.
Goodbye.
Yeah, right?
See what it was like back then.
Civil War surgery.
Pus is a good thing. Pus means it's healing. No, I don't think so.
Oh, look at all that healing.
All right. Well, Bob, tell us about the latest exoplanets that have been discovered.
Yeah, I'm actually surprised I haven't seen a lot more talk about this. This is really cool. Scientists say they've found three near-Earth-sized exoplanets orbiting around a brown dwarf just 40 light years away. All three offer us probably our best chances yet to find life outside of our solar system. And like I said, this is actually pretty damn exciting. Exoplanets have been all over the news for quite a few years now, but this discovery is really kind of a trifecta. Not only are they roughly Earth-sized, they're also close as hell, but they're also close as hell and orbiting a red dwarf, which means we could examine their atmospheres within a relatively short period of time. Scientists are saying that this is a jackpot for the field. This all happened because really one premier instrument, it's called TRAPPIST, That stands for Transiting Planets and Planetesimal Small Telescope. This is a 60-centimeter telescope operating by the University of Liege in Chile. This isn't a typical telescope looking for planets around bright stars. Often that's what we do because our star is bright in visible light and it clearly is spawned life. Here we are. And such stars are very easy to find. So it's kind of like low-hanging fruit. Cold dwarf stars, however, are faint. Most of their light is emitted in the infrared, and this makes them harder to spot. But such diminished light doesn't swamp out their planets, making it easier to examine them much more closely. So it's a trade-off and a really good one. So lead authors of the Nature paper on this, Michael Gillen and Emmanuel Jehin of the University of Liege, they took a risk and decided to create a proof-of-concept telescope that eventually became TRAPPIST. And instead of looking at thousands of stars at a time, like the Kepler Space Telescope did, TRAPPIST flagged only 60 dwarf stars that could be examined deeply one at a time. And now, after looking at only 15 of those 60 stars, it looks like they discovered something really huge, but not huge in size. They found an ultra-cool dwarf star 40 light years away, and it was called 2-mass J23069282805022285.
That will not be repeated.
And yes, and as I say a lot, that's an annoying name, but they actually gave it a new moniker, and they call it, of course, TRAPPIST-1.
Good.
TRAPPIST-1. So this star is just a little bigger than Jupiter, 1/8 the size of our sun, and it's a good bit cooler as well, as you might imagine. So they found three planets, TRAPPIST-1b, 1c, and 1d. B and C are in tight orbits. They're closer than Mercury, with an orbit that's less than 3 days. I think Ooh. One is like 1.5 days, the other one's like 2.5 days. But remember, this is a small, dim star. They both probably receive only a little bit more sunlight than Venus. Still, they're both just outside what we call the habitable zone, which allows liquid water on the surface.
I mean, they're just inside. They're too close.
Yeah. They're just outside the habitable
zone. Be confusing. These two are, just to be clear, these two are getting like 2 and 4 times as much radiation as the Earth.
Ooh. So they better have good magnetic fields or else
right.
nothing's going to happen.
And as I said, that puts them outside the habitable zone. Yeah. So you may be thinking, hey, these are so close to its star. Aren't they tidally locked? And yes, you would be very smart if you said that. It looks like they're probably tidally locked, which means they both have one side that permanently faces their sun, like the moon does to the Earth. So that also probably means that one side is too hot and the other side is too cold.
But there's a zone, which is just
yes. Right. Yes, that leaves a room for what I call a zone of awesomeness on each planet. And this area could get some light, but not the full brunt of it, leaving it cool enough for life to potentially develop on that.
Now, Bob, I was very interested in that fact about these three worlds.
Yes.
But first, we have to say that we can't observe that they are tidally locked. We're just assuming that they're tidally locked just because they're so close to their parent star. But what, you know, Mercury and Venus have a tidally resonant orbit with the sun. They're not the same face, doesn't face the sun. Like Mercury orbits 2 times for every 3 times
right.
that it rotates. So its day is like 176 of Earth days long. So it is essentially slowly rotating with respect to the sun. There's a ratio, a 3-to-2 ratio, a resonance between the spin orbital ratio. So how do we know that these planets don't have something like that going on? You know,
yeah, I don't think we know. That's why I threw the said probably tidally locked. That seems to be the consensus that it probably is. I'm not sure what would cause a specific tidal locking and what would cause something that you see with Mercury. And that was a huge anomaly in astronomy. Newton couldn't account for it, and it took Einstein and relativity to actually explain that. So that's a good question. And hopefully, you know, we'll eventually figure out, you know, if it's fully locked or if it's some sort of weird rotation like Mercury.
And would that be a good thing or a bad thing in terms of its prospects for life?
Yeah. That would probably be a bad thing. Yeah. That would be a bad thing.
Limiting factor.
Not good. So I hope it actually doesn't, because it seems like they're pinning a lot of hopes on this zone of awesomeness that would not be there if it was rotating. The third planet is called, of course, TRAPPIST 1D. It's farther out in the orbit, and it's a more of an ambiguous orbit at this point. They're saying that it could have an orbit between 4 and 73 days. So that's big variation there. They also said that this is probably tidally locked as well.
Wow.
But it appears to be well within the habitable zone, and it might get as much radiation as Earth. If it does, then the whole place could be potentially habitable. If it's more like Mars in that regard, then it could potentially be have a frozen surface, but with liquid life-filled subsurface similar to what we hope Europa is like. So that one does some good promise for that one as well. And actually, that could be the most promising. If it's getting a good dose of radiation, of solar radiation, then the whole planet could be kind of nice.
Also, we have to say these planets are all just a little bit bigger than Earth. And so so unlike Mars, right, this might be able to hold on to, maybe it has a magnetic field, maybe it's holding on to an atmosphere that has enough carbon dioxide in it to have a greenhouse effect that is keeping it warm.
Sure.
So there's lots of variables other than just distance and the brightness of the star. It's how reflective is the planet and what is in its atmosphere. Yeah.
Yeah, we weren't actually sure. We couldn't get a good grip on its mass, so we're not sure. We assume that it's rocky, and hopefully they are. And also, speaking of life, and this is a really good point to this whole thing, is that not only do these planets seem like good candidates, actually detecting it is tremendously helped by two separate characteristics that they all share. One is their propinquity, I love that word, to Earth. They are so close to us, 40 light years, that we could potentially detect their atmospheres if they have them. Something that we could never do with some of these exoplanets that might be, you know, thousands of light years or more away. Also, number two, they all orbit a dim dwarf star, which is incredibly beneficial, and it might not be obvious at first. The smaller the star, apparently, the larger the percentage of its light that gets filtered through a planet's atmosphere. So that's a bonus. And additionally, infrared light is also apparently great at absorbing biosignature chemicals in the atmosphere, like carbon dioxide, water vapor, oxygen. So the spectra of light that leaves the atmosphere would then be like a fingerprint for what gases the light pass through. So it's actually fantastic that it's an infrared star, because it could really help us kind of figure out what's in the atmosphere. So regarding the atmosphere, then, we can't really observe it yet. But Hubble should be able to tell us if the planets have one. That's a very good first step. If Hubble can't detect one at all, then things won't look good. Then we've got the James Webb Telescope, which should be in orbit by 2018, and that may be able to tell us what chemicals are there that might point to life. So I'll end with a quote from one of the scientists, DeWitt. He said, these planets are so close and their star so small, we can study their atmosphere and composition, and further down the road, which is within our generation, assess if they are actually inhabited. All of these things are achievable and within reach now. This is a jackpot for the field. So yeah, this is a really cool, one of the biggest exoplanet stories that we've had yet, I think. I mean, not just one planet, three that are close, that are similar to Earth in size, and orbiting a dwarf star, which is, and as you know, dwarf stars just litter the universe, and we just haven't really seriously built telescopes to look at them to see if there's exoplanets, because it's just, you know, it's a risk. Who wants to spend millions of dollars and then have it crash and burn? So this is a great proof of concept. They've only looked at 15 of the 60 dwarf stars on their list, so who knows what else they're going to find. I mean, so this could go in the record books if we imagine, you know, if we actually find, you know, the chemicals of life in the atmosphere. That would be the biggest news story of the century. It would be huge.
Yeah, it'd be awesome. That would be awesome. Oof. And there's a lot of these buggers. I think 15% of the closest suns to us are red dwarfs. So there's a lot of these. This could significantly increase the number of potential planets in our galaxy that could be harboring life.
How far away is it again?
40 light years. Yeah. Just a hop, skip, and a jump.
Yeah. Please.
Yeah, please.
That's nothing.
Backyard.
Yeah, that warp 6, you can get there in no time.
Open up that wormhole.
Quintillions of miles, but it's all relative.
Yeah. How many quintillion miles?
Okay, Evan.
Mm-hmm.
This is an interesting news item. I'm very unfortunate, but I think it's one that's important that we talk about. Summarize what's been going on between Mike Adams and David Gorski.
Mike Adams and David Gorski, yes. Okay. Well, as you know, Mike Adams is also known as the Health Ranger. That's a moniker he's given himself to make himself sound, I don't know, credentialed or something. And his website is called naturalnews.com. You might be familiar with the name and or the website.
Not to be confused with Nature News, which is legitimate.
There you go. Thank you. Mike Adams is an AIDS denier, meaning he doesn't think that AIDS is caused by HIV. He is anti-vaccine.
So he's an HIV denier, technically.
And I suppose you could say that is
I did.
A bit more accurate. Sure.
We call them HIV deniers, yes.
He is also anti-vaccination. He's a 9/11 truther. He's an Obama birther. You see a pattern here? He thinks chemtrails are real. He has advocated violence against GMO supporters. He equated Monsanto and its collaborators to Nazis. And perhaps most heinously, he has advocated the killing of scientists he deems to be criminals. So that just really scratches the surface of who Mike Adams is, but you need to kind of keep all that in mind.
Yeah, in other words, he's a dangerous lunatic.
Okay. Thank you, Steve. You can say those things. It means much more coming from you than I think it does from me. Adams recently wrote an article attacking David Gorski. David Gorski, as many of you know, is the managing editor of the website sciencebasedmedicine.org. And of course, SBM is a bulwark of medical rationality, fighting against quacks and snake oil salesmen who put people's lives at risk with their useless remedies and anti-scientific practices. As summarized by SBM, regarding the unfounded attacks on Gorski by Adams, this is how it part of it reads. Because of his criticism of pseudoscience and quackery on Usenet, online discussion forums, and blogs over the last 18 years, Dr. Gorski has angered some supporters of dubious health practices and pseudoscience. As a result, there are a number of articles and posts online that repeat misinformation and outright lies about him. Most recently, and this is the news item, in response to Dr. Gorski's criticism of an anti-vaccine movie directed by Andrew Wakefield and supported by Robert De Niro, Mike Adams resurrected the false 2010 charge of an undisclosed financial conflict of interest and written a series of screeds against him. For instance, that he sabotaged the entry for the movie on Wikipedia and accused of being in cahoots with a corrupt oncologist who bilked Medicare out of millions and gave chemotherapy to people who didn't have cancer. Adams has posted fake patient reviews and even claims to have reported Dr. Gorski to the FBI, Michigan Attorney General, and his state medical board. Worse, in doing so, Adams has made similar allegations against the cancer center where Gorski works in an effort to pollute the center's Google reputation along with Dr. Gorski's reputation. So, of course, David went on the defense and had needed to defend himself against Adams, even though a lot of it was, you know, downright ridiculous. Other things definitely needed to be addressed. So regarding the claim by Adams that Gorski edited the anti-vax movie's wiki page, Gorski wrote, "Adams really does seem to think that I have massive power over what Wikipedia does and does not publish about vaccines and medicine. Rather, it's all a sham, a con man's patter to convince his readers that I'm a major player in a conspiracy to manipulate health articles on Wikipedia from behind the scenes." And let me break away from that for a second. In fact, Adams went so far as to accusing Gorski of editing the wiki entry under an assumed name. But when David went and researched the edit history of that page, neither Gorski's name nor the assumed name showed up as having edited the entry. So what the hell is Adams even talking about?
He's just making shit up.
He's making stuff up so about crazy. Making stuff up. The layers are ridiculous here. These conflicts of interest that Adams accuses Gorski about, what's that all about? Well, here's what David has to say about that. Adams regurgitated a claim that I have an undisclosed financial conflict of interest with Sanofi Aventis because my research involves studying Rilutek, a drug made by the company, and this is why I so strongly oppose anti-vaccine groups. This is a lie originally published in a post on an anti-vaccine blog, Age of Autism, back in 2010 by a college student named Jake Crosby. It was baseless then and it is baseless now. As I said then, I have never received a dime from this company to study the drug. And they don't even own the U.S. rights to this anymore. They sold them back in 2013, so to talk about it as if it's still happening is ridiculous. It's also particularly risible to think that a surgical oncologist would be developing an autism drug for a pharmaceutical company. Not that Adams has ever concerned himself with how risible he sounds. Indeed, I have to wonder how much contempt Adam has for his own audience, given how downright idiotic his writing post sounds.
Complete. I mean, but that's like maybe the one reasonable thing about Mike Adams is that he understands exactly how brain dead his audience is, which unfortunately it's also huge.
Mm-hmm.
And just let me just quickly summarize the core of this claim is that David Gorski and the Karmanos Cancer Center is connected to this oncologist who was arrested and found guilty of essentially, you know, prescribing chemotherapy inappropriately to patients in order to bilk them of money and to bilk Medicare. Gorski actually wrote about this guy, you know, criticizing him, saying this guy is an evil scumbag for doing this, right? And now Adams is trying to connect them, and I think the only connection is that this guy rented an office in the same building as the Karmanos Cancer Center where David Gorski works with, you know, hundreds of other oncologists.
Yeah.
That's it. So they look for any tiny connection. It doesn't matter how tenuous it is, how incidental, how circumstantial it is, and then he weaves that into this grand conspiracy theory with Gorski as the sort of mastermind behind the scene pulling all of these, you know, strings. It's ridiculous.
It's so flaccid. You may as well say that there's a connection there because David Gorski and this other doctor, this Dr. Fata, used the same airport one day. And
yeah,
therefore
that's
there's
basically
a connection
it. That's essentially it. So this is partly how the conspiracy mind works, but I also I have to think, and this is, you know, I can't read Adam's mind, but it doesn't really make a difference anymore. He's acting as if he doesn't give a crap about what the truth is. That's what matters. He has a pathological disregard for the truth.
Mm-hmm.
As long as he could weave it into his conspiracy theory. I mean, he is actually slandering David Gorski and the Karmanos Cancer Center, you know, just in a horrific way. I also just very, very quickly, because I want to talk about sort of the bigger issue here, because after we had decided that we were going to talk about this, I read Kevin Folta's latest blog post where he talks about the fact that the Food Babe has successfully FOIA'd his email. So now she has in her grubby little hands like thousands of emails.
2,700 emails, right?
Yeah, 2,700 emails. And she's going to get to go through there and do the same thing. Look for any tenuous connection. And Kevin's trying to get, he's correctly trying to get ahead of it by saying, you know, these are the kind of things that she might be able to dig up. It's all innocent. It's all nothing. But she is, you know, almost certainly going to try to spin these incidental connections or statements or whatever. I mean, just imagine if somebody went trolling, somebody who hated you and was trying to destroy your reputation, went trolling through 2,700 of your emails. You know, that you
bound to
including
find some little
yeah
thing.
Including emails where you were speaking off the cuff to friends
yeah,
and colleagues
right. Well
know,
as
where,
long as they don't go through my browsing history, I'm pretty good.
That's a whole other thing. You're right, Steve. I wouldn't be surprised because I email Kevin a few times. Maybe a few of my emails are even in there.
Sure.
Oh, my emails with Kevin were in the first FOIA request. Oof. For sure.
And also,
like my name came out.
Students email, students who emailed him looking for advice. Mm-hmm. They're all in there.
It's
ridiculous.
Harassment.
It's harassment. It's absolutely harassment. And the connection between these two things, and I'll also connect it to the fact that, you know, the SGU was sued. I'm still mm-hmm. being sued. You know, even though we won the case in summary judgment, Tobinick appealed the case, and that's still ongoing. He's dragging this out as much as he possibly can. You know, racking up the cost. This has been, you know, ruinously expensive for the SGU. That these people are scumbags. That's the bottom line. These are not nice people. I know that it's easy to say that about people that you have an ideological disagreement with, but honestly, this is beyond just a disagreement of worldview. These are not nice people. They are gunning for us. They are gunning for skeptics individually, skeptics as a group.
Absolutely. And it doesn't stop at just medicine with Adams. You know, he's gone ahead in a more recent post and attacked the skeptical community directly.
Oh, yeah.
Directly he did.
This is the guy who had a hit list of people who he said were like Nazis and should be killed.
Yep.
You know, and David Gorski sure was did. On that list. I was on that list. A lot of other, you know, anybody who's decided that the science, you know, favors the safety of GMOs, they were on that list.
Jesus.
I mean, really, and the FBI, you know, speaking of FBI investigations that I mentioned earlier, FBI took a look at what Adams had to say when all that came down, you know, a couple of years ago. And I don't know what the end result was of that investigation. I don't think anything came of it. Nothing must have come of it, but the reports were that they did, you know, at least somebody was trying to take it seriously. You know, when you start threatening people like that, you do have to take it very seriously. And that's, you know, Mike Adams, it puts him in a whole other class of a dangerous, dangerous individual.
Oh, yeah. All right. We are going to do a What's the Word, Kara?
Yes. What is the word today? It is amphidromic. Does anybody have a guess as to what that means? Amphidromic. Well, Steve probably already knows.
I know. Yeah.
Well, I have no idea.
Okay.
I don't know. Suss it out.
So if we break it down, it is of Greek origin, but it's a pretty new word just happening within the last century. And amphi and drome. Drome is a root that kind of translates to running. And amphi, which we actually hear that word. Have you guys heard other science words with that root? Like amphipathic?
I haven't heard that one. I've heard other words with dromic in it, like
amphidromic. Oh, interesting. And I've heard other words with amphi in it, like an amphipathic molecule, right, is both water soluble and liposoluble. So that would be meaning both.
Yeah. And in, for dromic, in terms of like running, like if we're conducting nerves, if you conduct in an antidromic direction, that's against the direction that the nerve normally conducts.
Oh interesting. Yeah. So it is basically running both ways. That's sort of the rough translation. Does that help you guys at all? Probably not. So it was actually suggested by a listener named Jerry from Reading in the United Kingdom. And he says, I have a suggestion for what's the word? Amphidromic, a point where there's almost zero tides. I only heard this word for the first time today while researching places to stay in Norway. And so the dictionary definition is, of course, a little bit more complicated. A point of almost zero tidal fluctuation on the ocean surface, represented on a chart of co-tidal lines by a point from which these lines radiate. Or an even more sophisticated definition from Merriam-Webster, relating to a system of tidal action in which the tide wave progresses around a point or center of little or no tide. So that's often called the amphidromic point or the amphidromic region. So I think to understand this a little better, we have to understand tides, right?
Mm-hmm.
You guys know what the biggest contributor to tides on Earth is?
The moon.
The moon?
And what's the other contributor?
The sun.
And the moon's a little more than two times more powerful a contributor or more significant a contributor than the sun. Yeah. The sun really often works to either intensify the tidal effect of the moon or to or to bring it down a little bit. Yes, attenuate it. Thank you. I was like, detensify, that's a word.
it is now.
I'm so glad I'm the one who does this segment. And so when we think about the way that the tides work, they're actually, by the way, crazy complicated. And you can kind of break your brain really trying to wrap your head around every single thing that contributes to the tides. But generally speaking, let's say you're taking Oceanography 101 and you want to learn the basic components. There are three big things that contribute to the tides. The Earth, of course, because the Earth is the body that has the water, the moon, and the sun. And so how much does the moon versus the sun contribute to the tides?
Yeah, the moon's much more contributes much more than
twice as much.
Yeah, like even a little more than twice as much because it's obviously so much closer. Now the sun does contribute but really more in just making the tides more intense or pulling the tides back so that they're less intense. It doesn't actually make the tides go in any sort of different direction or anything. The reasoning behind the tides at the simplest level is because of two major forces at play, gravity and centrifugal force. So when you think about the fact that, you know, at any given time, the moon is actually rotating around the Earth, at any given time, the closest point between the moon and the Earth is where we're going to see the largest tidal bulge. And that's both a contribution of the pure forces of gravity, because the Earth is you know, covered by this liquid body, and the liquid body, actually, you can see the effects of the force of gravity on liquid much more than you can on solid objects that are planted on the Earth. So it's both a contribution of the bulging because of the force of gravity, but also this centrifugal force, because when the Earth spins, you actually see kind of a pinching in around that around that axial point. So you've got both the bulge towards the moon and the pinching in around the body of the Earth. It's a little bit confusing, right? Because there's also a tide on the exact opposite point where the moon is. But if you think about it, it makes sense because you both have this this force from the spinning. So you've got this pinching sort of around the waist. You've got the bulge that's closest to the moon. The bulge that's farthest away from the moon is contributed to by that centrifugal force. It's also because it's not just the water that's being, you know, has a gravitational force exerted on it. The whole Earth has a gravitational force exerted on it. And so the point that's the farthest away is actually physically moving away from the Earth as the Earth has that gravitational pull on it. So you see all of these factors combined, and that's in the simplest model ever. Like, we're drawing it on a graph. Contribute to that all sorts of other factors, like the placement where we are in relation to the sun, because like I said, the sun can either increase or decrease the effect of the moon's gravity, and also things like the Coriolis effect, which is more of a mathematical principle. Obviously, if we're talking about normal Newtonian laws of motion, if I'm going to throw a paper airplane from the North Pole down to an intended target on the equator, I'm going to expect that it goes in a straight line. But because the Earth is rotating, it's actually going to veer off of course. And we see the same thing happening with the tides. And that's how you have these spins, these kind of eddies, these big rotational portions of the tides when you start mapping out the entire Earth. Now, the amphidromic points on the Earth are the places where we can physically map out all of these little spots where these forces kind of come together. And they're sometimes called amphidromic points. They're also called tidal nodes, and you can physically map them. And the nice thing is they make for a really great vacation. Why, did you ever wonder why people go to Tahiti so often? Well, it's an amphidromic point, and that's because the Coriolis effect is actually spinning around in such a way that you find these points on the Earth where the water's pretty calm. I know we say zero. I'm not sure that it's fair to say zero. I think there are some
approaching
places that
zero,
have,
maybe.
But approaching zero. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's physically based on a measurement of the amplitude of the tide itself. Between high tide and low tide, make a calculation of the difference. If it doesn't seem to be that there's a difference, then we're talking about an amphidromic point.
Hmm.
But oceanographers that are listening, I know you will have a lot more to say about this. I'm not saying don't send in your corrections. I'm not saying I don't want to learn more, because I absolutely do. But of course, this is a huge oversimplification of tidal physics. There is a lot that comes into play.
Yeah, it's like every time I hear somebody try to like thoroughly explain how the tides work, it seems like it's mm-hmm. different. You know,
oh, yeah.
It's like a slightly different, or sometimes not so slightly different, explanation about what the people are trying to figure out different ways to like really explain what's happening.
It's yeah.
Damn, it's complicated.
It is. It's very complicated. There's lots of different people saying lots of different ways. Ultimately, though, if you had to boil it down to two words, it's caused by tidal acceleration. That's the key. And I recommend go to YouTube and look for a video called What Physics Teachers Get Wrong About Tides.
Yep.
Oh, nice.
By PBS Digital Studios. Wonderful. The best explanation I have ever come across. Cool. And remember two words. It's all about tidal acceleration.
Or as an alternative for alternative science, you can go to Bill O'Reilly and he'll tell you. The tides go in, the tides go out. We don't know why.
All right. Just one quick correction before we go on to science or fiction. I, off the cuff, with my flawed memory, quoted Dune. And Jay asked me a question about Dune.
Scandalous.
And yeah, I know. It was like, so, Muad'Dib had two names. He had a Sich name, which was Usul, which Usul, I said, was the mouse shadow in the crater of the moon. But it's really the strength of the base of the pillar. The mouse shadow is Muad'Dib. That's the name of the mouse shadow on the moon.
Excuse you.
Yeah,
oh, no. Muad'Dib. Egregious.
So he is
egregious.
Paul Muad'Dib.
I had a ferret once that I named Lotus Luwal Muad'Dib, which I thought was a wonderful name.
That is amazing.
And it only responded to
Lotus for sure.
Now,
so thanks to everybody who sent in that correction. I know. I temporarily
both,
lose
yes.
one nerd point, but I will earn it back.
I'm not worried.
All right, guys. Well, let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. And you all can play along at home, if you choose. Are you guys ready for this week? We have a theme. The theme this week is inspired by an anniversary yesterday. Cinco de Mayo, May the 5th, was what?
It was yesterday.
Yesterday, as we were recording, what else was significant about that day?
It was the day after May the 4th be with you.
It was the first manned Mercury mission.
Oh, awesome. That was pretty much the beginning of it all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was manned, man.
Yeah, that was Alan Shepard.
Yes.
Yep. Mission date, May the 5th, 1961. So the theme is the Mercury program. Questions about the Mercury program.
I'm going to kick ass.
I'm going to fail miserably.
Really, Jay?
A huge fan, Bob.
Huge fan of Mercury.
Okay. We'll see. Here we go. Item number one. 20 separate Mercury spacecraft were built for the Mercury program, but only 15 were ever flown. Item number two. The Mercury capsule was only capable of manned flight for a maximum of a day and a half, which was achieved on the final mission by L. Gordon Cooper, lasting 34 hours, 19 minutes, and 49 seconds. And item number three. John Glenn was the first American to orbit the Earth in the capsule Freedom 7, so named because it was the seventh mission of the Mercury program. Evan, go first.
What about the number of spacecraft built? Yeah, I don't have a problem with this one, per se. 20 of the spacecraft were built, only 15 were ever flown. That's not unusual, as my recollection is, with our space programs. We do build some extras and they don't make it up. I don't think. Did Enterprise ever, for space shuttles, for example, ever make it up? I don't think Enterprise ever did.
No.
Right.
Space worthy.
So I think that one's okay. The next one about manned flight for a maximum of a day and a half. L. Gordon Cooper lasting 34 hours, 19 minutes, 49 seconds. But it was only capable for that. Would it have been capable for longer, I suppose? Or did it exceed its capability? Maybe is the other way you can look at this one. I don't know. I really just don't know about that one. The last one about Freedom 7. Okay, so was Freedom 7 the seventh one? Again, you either know that one or you don't know that one. There's not really much to go on there.
Yeah, this is more knowledge based than really your ability to reason through.
Oh boy,
damn trivia.
Well, I mean, it sounds reasonable, but, you know, this one could... This is a 50-50 for number three. I'll say, therefore, that I'll go... Since I got 50-50 on the last one, number seven, I'll take my shot there. I don't think it was the seventh mission of the Mercury program, or that's... I should say that it was not named Freedom 7 because it was the seventh mission. I'll say that one's fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Can't Jay go before me?
No.
All right. So, yeah, I know squat about the Mercury program. 20 separate spacecraft sounds like a lot. The potential fact that only 15 of the 20 were flown. Sure, there's some precedence for that kind of thing. That's kind of okay. Let's see. Maximum of a day and a half. Whatever. I don't know. The third one. Yeah, this is the one that I've got I can kind of think my way into, I think. Freedom 7. I think Glenn was perhaps, not the seventh. I think he was a little bit earlier. I could be horribly wrong, of course. But also, why would you call it Freedom 7? I mean, wouldn't it be like Mercury 7? So I think that the Freedom 7 came from somewhere else.
Okay.
So fiction.
Okay, Kara.
I don't know any of these. They're all pure trivia that I have no idea about. So I'm going to GWEB. And go with Bob and Evan.
Gonna jump off that cliff with Bob and Evan.
Okay. I'm gonna hold hands really tight.
Okay.
GWBE.
All right. And Jay, the self-proclaimed expert.
The first one about the 20 separate Mercury spacecraft seems quite correct to me. Just going off of memory, dozens of TV shows I've watched, documentary films, books I've read. You know, basically just absorbing knowledge from the ethos. That seems perfectly cromulent, and I have nothing to argue there. The second
pretty
one,
pretty flimsy, Jay. Pretty flimsy.
You know about the Mercury capsule? I know, Bob. How do I say?
Jay's a Mercutian, Bob. You must trust his
this opinion. Mercury capsule was only capable of man flight for a maximum of a day and a half. Those missions lasted, what was it, like 4 hour missions, I think. There was a, depending
three
on
three and a half, I think, Jay.
How
three
long,
and a half.
How long or how many times or
3 hours
how much time they want the, how far they want them to go. So yeah, I think that one is definitely science.
Yeah, baby.
They didn't build them to last longer than they needed, and they were trying to figure out worst case scenarios type of things like that. But that was a pretty long time for them to build a manned spacecraft to last a day and a half. If you remember, like, those guys had to go to the bathroom in their spacesuits because there was no, like, getting undressed and going to the bathroom. So, like,
holy crap.
Not expected to stay in
their
suits that long. Yep. Yeah, it was a big deal, Bob. The guy that is in charge of, I forget the title of the station, but the guy that was in charge of, like, the spacesuits had to, like, say, okay, he can go pee in his spacesuit. It should be fine. But it was a thing because there was without going too far into detail, somebody had to do that even before they took off because they had massive delays in the launch. The next item, I'm just going to flat out say I disagree. I don't believe that John Glenn was on the seventh mission. That's all I'll say. So that one is the fiction.
Well,
all right. So you guys all agree on this one.
I'm feeling good about this one.
So we'll see
good.
How you did.
I'm confused, but
we'll start with number one. 20 separate Mercury spacecraft were built for the Mercury program, but only 15 were ever flown. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Yay.
Jay. Mm-hmm. Jay.
Yes.
Jay.
Who built them?
Joe Mercury.
Company?
What company built them?
Oh, the Mercury car.
Oh, shit, Steve. That's a great question. I'm going Boeing. To say
nope.
Boeing or Sikorsky.
Nope.
Who's the other one?
McDonald's.
Oh, wait. Wasn't it a car company? Who was it?
McDonnell Douglas.
Not McDonnell Douglas. McDonnell. Before they were McDonnell Douglas.
Okay.
We only know it as McDonnell Douglas.
Yeah.
And I think maybe
McDonnell Aircraft was... And they did such a good job, NASA gave them the Gemini contract without even bidding. They just said, okay, yeah. You did a great job on Mercury. You could do Gemini as well.
Did you know that some of the astronauts pronounced that word Gemini?
Gemini.
Gemini,
Gemini yep.
Gemini?
Yep.
It's like hegemony.
I thought
hegemony?
The same thing, Jay. Yes.
Yeah, but it's Gemini.
here we go.
Yeah, so they built 20 of them. That's interesting. There were 20 of them out there. Two were destroyed. For various reasons. One was lost.
Burned up,
the
right?
The fire. Burned on the launch pad?
No, that was
that was Apollo. That's Apollo.
That was Apollo.
Astronauts died in that. That was three guys that died in that.
Including Gus Grissom,
yeah.
Who almost drowned on his Mercury mission. Because
you wonder why?
Because he accidentally blew.
Accidentally, maybe out of nerves, blew the hatch.
Blew the hatch, and he said it just blew.
Yeah. They tested the hell out of that spacecraft to make sure that the explosive bolts wouldn't ever explode on their own. Even if the spacecraft hit pavement, they would not explode on their own. And his mysteriously opened when he was in the ocean. So I'm definitely of the camp that
user
freaked
error?
Out. Yeah, and we lost that craft, by the way.
Mm.
Yeah, it was recovered years later, decades later. Yeah. But he almost drowned. I mean, he had to get out of there really quick, and then he could only swim for so long in his space suit, in his flight suit. So, yeah, they were supposed to wait for them to attach, I guess, the hook to the top of the capsule so they could keep it from sinking before he blew the hatch. And
what was he sinking?
He had a premature explosion there. Yeah, right. Okay, let's go on to number two. The Mercury capsule was only capable of manned flight for a maximum of a day and a half, which was achieved on the final mission by L. Gordon Cooper, lasting 34 hours, 19 minutes, and 49 seconds. You guys all think this one is science? Let me ask you a question.
Yes.
What do you think was the limiting factor? If you think this one is science, why was the capsule only good for 34-hour missions?
I have a couple of guesses. I'm going to tell you what my best one is. I mean, you could just say oxygen, but I'm thinking retrograde.
What do you mean?
Meaning that it was re-entering. They couldn't actually get it into an orbit that lasted.
Oh, so you think it's a limitation of the launch vehicle.
So orbital decay then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. No, that's not it. You were right the first time. It was the amount of oxygen. It was food, water, and oxygen that it could hold. It could keep in it.
That's,
keep an astronaut alive for a day and a half.
So the issue wasn't that there wasn't enough oxygen after, or the issue was that there wasn't enough oxygen after 34 hours, not that it would have too much carbon dioxide in the capsule.
That's what they said, the supply of oxygen. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I guess it's the same thing if you think about it.
Well, not really, because you have the you have the carbon scrubbers, right? So they probably lasted longer.
There you go. Yeah, you can actually have a little carbon sink in there.
Just ran out of oxygen. Yeah, it was tiny. It was a man in a can, right? These things were tiny. They were only meant for short missions. They weren't designed for long missions. The mission of the Mercury program was to test just getting an astronaut into orbit and bringing him back safely. And also to the secondary mission was to see how an astronaut would perform in the environment of space. You know, whether they didn't pass out or whatever. And they had no idea, right? So they had to test it.
Well, the monkeys did okay.
Yeah, dogs, monkeys.
They did send a monkey up first, which pissed the astronauts off. Yeah. But they did do that. And
Steve, it's painful to hear you talking about all this because I want to talk about all this.
You can talk about it too. Well, after we do the third one, then we'll take the. Did I tell you if this is science or fiction yet?
No, you did not.
This one is science.
Hey, yeah, baby.
Yay.
Yeah,
of course. We
of
win.
Of course.
Yeah, you win.
How did we sweep this? Jesus.
Yeah, it's so mean that he made Jay go last.
It wasn't a limit of the capsule, really. It was just how much space it had to store enough food and water and whatnot. And then they upgraded it for Gemini so that the capsule was bigger. It could hold two astronauts. And they also wanted it to make it to last a lot longer. Now, Jay, Gagarin.
Yuri?
Yuri Gagarin. By how much time did he beat the U.S. in getting into space?
One second.
How long was it before when they launched him?
Alan Shepard. How long after Gagarin did Shepard go up?
It was kind of close. Like a couple months.
It was weeks, I think.
Yeah, it was weeks, like 2 weeks.
Yep.
And NASA could very well have beat the Russians.
Yep, we could have beat them.
But they wanted to do another test mission, and they were just being cautious because they had no idea how close the Russians were because they didn't tell anybody. The Soviets didn't publicize any of their missions until after they were successful. So we had no idea.
Good for them, man. That space race was important. You know, if you got to think about it, that pressure was making both the countries push
and
really hard.
They had bigger rockets, and their capsule was actually bigger because they had bigger rockets, and therefore they had a bigger capsule, which could last much longer. And they had much longer. Their initial missions were much longer. Like Gagarin orbited the Earth like four times. And
yeah, it was a big deal.
Yeah, the next mission lasted 4 days, you know.
That's okay. We got to the moon first.
Yeah, that's true.
It's all good. We got the brass ring.
At this point, I'm just like, if humanity gets anywhere, I'm happy.
Yeah,
you know?
Like, so all this means that John Glenn was the first American to orbit the Earth in the capsule Freedom 7, so named because it was the seventh mission of the Mercury program. Is the fiction? Why, Jay?
Because it was Alan freaking Shepard that did it first.
No.
Alan Shepard was the first Mercury mission pilot.
Yeah, but I said to orbit the Earth, the first orbital mission.
I thought John Glenn was the first American
to
orbit the Earth. Oh,
John
so that
Glenn,
wasn't the wrong part.
It was correct. John Glenn.
Oh, God, I still got it right, but I thought you meant who did the first Mercury flight.
Shepard was a suborbital flight. They did two suborbital missions, Alan Shepard and Grissom, and then they did several orbital missions and they had a bigger rocket, right? So the suborbital missions used a Redstone rocket, and the missions were named Mercury Redstone. So Shepard's was Mercury Redstone 3, and Grissom's was Mercury Redstone 4. For the orbital flights, because they had to get up higher, they used Atlas rockets. So that was Mercury Atlas 6, Mercury Atlas 7. So John Glenn's mission was the Mercury Atlas 6 mission, which was the first orbital flight. He was up for 4 hours, 55 minutes, and 23 seconds and orbited the Earth three times.
And it wasn't Freedom, was it?
Why was it named Freedom?
It wasn't
Freedom.
It wasn't Freedom. His capsule was the Friendship 7.
Oh, God, it's so close.
Oh, so this one's all kinds of problems with
Steve,
this one.
Steve.
And why was it the Friendship 7?
The Freedom 7 was the first capsule.
Yes, that was Shepard's capsule.
So they're both
capsule.
Seven.
Shepard's capsule.
Seven.
Yeah, hang on. Shepard's capsule was Freedom 7. Grissom's was Liberty Bell 7. Glenn's was Friendship 7.
Oh, they're all sevens.
Scott Carpenter was Aurora 7. William Shearer was Sigma 7 and Gordon Cooper was Faith 7.
It's because you just named seven people.
Because they were the Mercury 7.
Nice.
The right stuff.
They all, the astronauts were allowed to name their own capsule, and they all decided to give it the designation 7.
That's cool.
In honor of the Mercury 7 and astronauts.
I love that.
That's going to be the next name of any band that I'm in, the Mercury 7.
Yeah, I like it.
It's a trio.
And it's the band is me. So far, the band is me, Steve, and George.
That would be cool.
It would be cool.
All right, Jay, Mr. Expert, name the Mercury 7 astronaut who never flew in the Mercury mission.
The guy who didn't do it.
Johnny McStayholm.
Forrest Gump.
Who didn't? All right, there was a trained astronaut.
One of the seven. One of the seven.
Yeah, who's the seven?
That was six. I just named you six manned Mercury flights.
I got it. I got it, and I have to admit that part of it is the movie. Wasn't it Deke? Deke something?
Deke Slayton.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
That is impressive.
Nice. Science.
Deke Slayton had atrial fibrillation, and so he was grounded during the Mercury mission.
Oh, that sucks.
But you know what they said to him, Steve?
Yeah.
You're a Deke.
But
don't be
he did fly an Apollo. He did a docking module pilot of the 1975 Apollo Soyuz test project. He was 51, and at the time, he was the oldest person to fly in space. Two people have since surpassed him.
That's right.
John Young in 1988, who was 53.
And Buzz Aldrin.
Nope.
No.
And?
Come on, guys.
It's a Glenn.
John Glenn.
John Glenn.
Who went up in the space shuttle when he was 77.
No way.
77.
Yep. Yes, he did.
That's
like
crazy.
A champ.
That's what I was freaking awesome. Champ.
STS-95, John Glenn flew at the age of 77.
I'm actually surprised they let him do that.
He had the twice stuff.
Yeah, he did. No, he's badass. Absolutely. All right, well, hey, good job, everyone. You guys did it.
Yeah.
You guys swept me.
It was totally because of me, too.
Yeah.
Totes.
You set the pace. You know everything about this.
Totally.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
Here we go. This week's quote. A scientific idea may require a lot of reasoning to work out an appropriate test, may be difficult to test, may require the development of new technological tools to test, or may require one to make independently testable assumptions to test. But to be scientific, an idea must be testable somehow, some way. You think they drove the point one there? I think so. Courtesy of Berkeley University's Understanding Science webpage called What is Science? Which is really
author?
A good read.
Is there an author on that page?
No, there was no specific author. So we have to credit just Berkeley University. And it's actually quite a good read. Hopefully we'll put the link up to that. It's very cool. And yes, testable, folks. Testable. If it's not testable, it is not science. You can't have one without the other.
Right. It's a necessary but insufficient criterion for being considered a science.
Right.
All right. Well, thank you, Evan.
You're welcome.
And thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, Steve.
All right, Dak.
Thank you.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.